Part 070. It turned out that Jack and I didn't see each other until New Year's Day when he came by train as early as he could. We weren't concerned about the groom not supposed to see the bride in advance. By contrast, we were deathly worried that train delays would mean we missed getting married. We'd had a lively correspondence throughout December. Jack had quite easily managed to get a ring. For sizing, we'd made several traces of the ring I'd kept as well as a mark on a cardboard wedge. Jack's parents had decided to close their shop for the day and come to the wedding. Audrey, however, was not given leave, but that was normal in these very abnormal times. The WI ladies insisted on a wedding lunch in St. James Hall, and also insisted I make no attempt to interfere with their plans. In retrospect, I believe Jack would have found a number of contraventions of the rationing regulations if he had been inclined to investigate how they acquired some of the items we consumed after our register office ceremony. I believe, however, that Jack himself was guilty of destroying some of the evidence by virtue of consuming it with relish. George took photos, letting Oliver hold the camera so he got in one or two pictures. Jackie Hazelton had a camera too, saying just in case there's an accident with developing those George is taking. Most people say a registry office wedding, but I noticed that the plaque for the one where we married clearly said register office, and since it is the place where the register of marriages, births and deaths is kept, registry is a slip. But realizing that it mentioned that deaths were recorded, I had a moment of unease. Where was Joan Mary Smith's death recorded? Part 071. Jack had told me he would take care of a short honeymoon. He had work on Monday, but not until the afternoon. Somehow he got some police friends to pick us up from the church hall at 2 o'clock. They made a great show of arresting us. For a moment I had a sick feeling they might be there for, well, the reasons that scared me. But it was all a nice gift to get us to Taunton Station in time for the train that we'd take. Mabel had lent me a suitcase, saying you can't take a rucksack on your honeymoon. On the platform, I asked Jack, "Where are we going?" "Now that we're out of the crowd, I can tell you. I've booked us 3 nights in the Randolph Hotel in Oxford. Plenty of things to see there, and it's avoided the bombings. By the way, I really like your costume and coat. You did well. And no fussing about changing to leave. Well, I still owe Matilda a coupon. If I'd had a wedding dress, I wouldn't have the costume. And I've only my old nightdress that I fixed up from a second-hand one. Perhaps there's a new wartime regulation that newlywed brides aren't allowed to wear nightdresses. Given how we've behaved before, it would not be a great surprise if the regulation were unnecessary. But it might be quite cold and, I'm afraid to say, my monthlies came later than I expected. I whispered the last bit, as I didn't want all and sundry on the platform, which was fortunately not crowded, to know my private business. "Does that mean we won't be able to, Jack seemed anxious. I talked to Mabel, and she said there's no danger, only possible messiness, so we should take a bit of care to lie on a towel. And she said that her doctor had said there was much less likelihood of getting in the family way at that time, though apparently it could happen. Jack said we'll manage, and I knew we would. Our trains, with only minor delays, got us to Oxford, so we were at the hotel by 6 o'clock. On the way we talked quite a bit about what we'd like as a future. It seemed Jack wanted to stay in the police, and that made sense. He was doing well, and would likely get to be a senior officer at quite a young age. He already was. We both wanted a place to live that had room to grow things, and Jack thought we might keep an eye out for somewhere that would allow a smaller version of the Gaffney's place. One I could manage more or less on my own. I'd really like that, I think." I asked about children, and it seemed we both assumed we would have some, though both of us wanted to wait until the war was over to start. Until then, rubber. Or perhaps near my monthlies. Pity it was so awkward. The Randolph was imposing. We probably could have walked from the station, but took a taxi, which pulled up by the wide entrance steps. Jack, can we afford this? It's pretty swish. Mrs. Morrison, we can afford 3 nights quite easily. More than that, and I'll have to send you out to work.
Oh,
but you already work. We had no difficulties registering. Jack's identity card was one of the special ones with a photograph, and he was listed as Detective Inspector. I handed mine to the clerk with one of the 2 smaller marriage certificates we'd arranged to get with the large main one. Congratulations, Detective Inspector and Mrs. Morrison. I hope your stay here will be one that gives happy memories. Part 072. The room had its own bathroom. What a luxury, even if there was a line for the allowed depth. And somehow there was a very little, heat in the radiator. The dinner we had on Friday was good, even though it had to conform to the rationing regulations. Or was it good because we were together and just married? Given it was wintertime, we were lucky to have only a trace of rain, though the temperature wasn't much above freezing. We walked a lot, looking at the town and the colleges. On Saturday afternoon we walked across Port Meadow, one of the few remaining common grazing areas in the country. In a pamphlet on Oxford that we found, it was reportedly given to the Freeman of Oxford by Alfred the Great, though that was, according to a footnote, a legend, but the right to graze animals was in the Domesday Book. There were remnants of a military camp on the meadow. In 1940 it was used for soldiers who escaped Dunkirk, but the tents were now gone and just some signs of pathways and tent pegs remained. We were able to get a meal in the Trout, then had quite a walk back to the Randolph. We didn't mind. We were together, and happily so. Some of the colleges had been taken over by different military units for use for training. A few, like Wardham, appeared to be still functioning more or less as always, though this was too early for the term to start, so it was very quiet. There was lots to see, and I suppose I should have been more interested in the stories of the places, but it was enough to be with Jack and sharing the time and the places. I'd read about Oxford, but the variety of different types of views and buildings and land surprised me. Of course, so much was historical, but still in use. Jack took me to the Bear, a truly ancient pub where even I had to duck to avoid bumping my head. Part 073. We took an early train on Monday. Jack was going back to Bath. I was returning to Taunton. After we'd parted, no tears, but we both were subdued. It seemed being married didn't feel much different from before when Jack and I took some time together. On the other hand, I found a sense of comfort, of coming home, as the train pulled into Taunton. Unfortunately, no rucksack and I had to walk to the farm. My fingers got a bit tired with the suitcase, but it could have been worse. Toby, especially, but also Reggie both seemed pleased I was back. Mabel was out on the plots checking how things were doing, but Matilda was doing the laundry. "If you're quick, I can do some of your things in the next batch," she offered. So I hurried upstairs and changed into my work clothes and gathered my laundry and hurried downstairs. "It's a mixed bunch, I'm afraid, so some will have to wait for next week, but nothing's critical," I said. Matilda selected the items that would go with the next set of clothes to be put in the galvanized tub we used for washing and put the smallest amount of soap in too. We rinsed in the sink, and often would do the heavy work clothes in a second shift in the soapy water. The main thing with the outdoor clothes was to get the mud and muck off them. I gave Matilda a hand with the rinsing and hanging up. We weren't drying in the kitchen today, as the weather was decent, so I took things out to the lines in the yard and hung them using the gypsumade pegs and raised the line with our ancient but trusty prop. Toby followed me around. He seemed worried I might go away again. Silly hound. I wasn't going to desert him. About 1:15 Mabel came in. "There you are. Have a nice time." "Very. Thanks for asking." Jack had booked 3 nights in the Randolph Hotel in Oxford. A room with its own bath and toilet. Luxury, even with the line in the tub and not much heating. Good for him, Matilda said. You want to get off to a good start. Yes. Pity we can't stay together just yet, but I suppose we're doing better than a lot of couples. Mabel said yes, some'll have two nights and then several years apart. That'll make it difficult to build a good marriage later. I changed the subject and asked what I should consider working on. There's not a lot in the plots. Maybe a good time to check all the baskets and flats. Clean them up and fix any breaks as best we can. Also sort out the stakes and strings for tomatoes and beans. It's rather dull work, but now's a good time to have a go at it. We had some soup. We called it lucky soup because you were lucky if you could guess what was in it, since we tossed in bits and bobs of vegetables and scraps of meat. There were wedges of national loaf with a little dripping and Marmite. Then I put on my sailing jacket and my work gloves and went to the buyer with Toby. Fortunately, I remembered my key. Toby darted in, but got no rat today. In fact, I think he'd pretty well got all the resident vermin out of the buyer. I went up to the loft and opened the door for light. I found a brush that had a handle and started on the bushel baskets. They were mostly pretty clean. Occasionally some leaves of bits of grass and soil. Two needed some sort of repair, and I didn't know exactly what to do with those. Have to ask Mabel. Probably some sort of reweaving of the reed or straw. Anyway, I set those two aside and then worked on the flats. The flats generally needed more cleaning. Some had decayed remnants of vegetables or fruit, and those I took outside and got a bucket of water and a scrubbing brush to clean. Then I set them to dry on edge so they wouldn't collect water that might cause damage to the wood. A few had loose slats. I found the pliers and pulled out the nails, sometimes removing the slats, then re-nailed them if the wood were good. A few needed new slats. I rummaged in the loose lumber we had and found some I could use. The saw and workbench were handy, and I got this done quickly. But we didn't have a lot more wood of the right dimensions. Better talk to Oliver about scrounging for more. Make do and mend. I didn't have time today to do all the repairs, and there was a pile of sacks I should check for holes, but it was getting dark so I closed and locked the buyer and headed to the house. Toby had been lying watching me work, and he jumped up to accompany me. I wonder how he'd take to Jack when we finally got to all be together. Part 074. In early June 1943, Jack got a weekend off and came to Taunton. We found we could fit in my bed quite comfortably, though it was naturally crowded. We did take Saturday night in a local hotel. That evening, Jack said, "Let's go to the Vivory Arms for a drink." Apparently, the American Medical Corps people often drop in there. They've set up the Musgrave Park Hospital near there and taken over Norton Manor Camp as a supply depot for medical stuff. It's apparently the oldest inn in Taunton. By now I knew Jack well enough to say, "Must be some villains cooking something up that you want to sniff out." Jack laughed. "Well, yes. You'll provide nice camouflage for me. There's been rumors some of the American troops in either the hospital or the depot or both are doing some black market trading. They have lots of cans of peaches, cartons of cigarettes and so on. I'm not sure what we have to offer in return." There was a fellow, said his name was Gene Hammond, who tried to chat to me about strawberries when I was weeding them a couple of weeks ago. They're a high-value crop, but strawberries would be a small sideline if he's seriously involved. You and Mabel do well with your production, but I think these fellows are looking for something bigger. Possibly trading heirloom jewelry or paintings or antiques. When we got to the Vivory, Jack ordered me a half of cider. He didn't bother to ask, and I was going to chide him when I realized that I would have asked for that anyway. He also knew that I'd have said in advance if I wanted something different. He got himself a pint of bitter and suggested we find a seat outside. I thought that odd until we'd sat down and who should come to the pub but the man I'd mentioned, Gene Hammond. Gene went inside, then came out with a glass of what was probably beer. He came over to where we were sitting and said in a loud voice, "Mary, the strawberry lady, won't you introduce your fellow?" I didn't really want to do this, but in a very cool manner said, "This is my husband, Jack." Emphasis on husband. "Good to meet you, Jack." Then, much, much more softly, "Sorry to have to leave off the titles." He and Jack shook hands and Jean sat down across the rough table that had several chairs around it. Jack, not overly loud, but audible to anyone near, asked, "Are you with the hospital?" Jean said, "No. I'm a stores manager at Norton Manor Camp." Jack whispered to me, "But also military police." Jean asked, "How are the strawberries coming along? We could sure use some to cheer up some badly wounded guys in the hospital. I think we'll be picking some early ones soon. The production is, of course, pretty well committed to local shops and the Women's Institute jam." "Yes, I've heard what a great job your WI does with preserving and canning. Set a big challenge for our American gals to do as well." Jack, lifting his glass to apparently take a long draft, whispered, "Some small amounts of produce will allow Jean and I to share messages." Thereafter, the conversation was almost entirely mundane until we'd finished our drinks and Jean said, "Let me give you guys a lift back. I've a Jeep, and plenty of gas." This let Jean and Jack agree that I'd work with Mabel to prepare the odd flat of something special that would be provided in exchange for some cans of peaches, evaporated milk, or some chocolate. Nylons were offered, but I said that would be too blatant. We could argue that the barter of food for food was reasonable and more or less expected when British families entertained American servicemen. Nylons would be seen as black market or else would reflect badly on the morals of Gaffney's farm women. Jack and Jean laughed. "If I bring a chocolate bar, look inside the wrapper. 4 peaches, under the label. The labels to watch for will be a little torn at the edge. You get the idea." I nodded. Jean let us off at our hotel, and we retired early. In bed, Jack said, "I wondered if I should tell you about Jean in advance, but I wanted your initial reaction to be rather a cold shoulder so nobody got suspicious. There may have been some of the crooks there drinking." "How will I pass messages to Jean?" I asked. "We can use your invoice or bill of lading to tell him that there's a message hidden somewhere he knows how to find. If the second last digit of the invoice number is odd, then there's a message. Otherwise not." "Is this a dangerous operation, Jack?" "Possibly. But we don't know yet quite what the objective is. It's likely purely for material gain, but in wartime, it could cover espionage or sabotage. So it could be our duty to find out?"
"Not could be. Is.
But right now we can do something else for national service."
"Right now.
What?" Jack seemed confused. "Make sure our equipment is all fully functional."
"Oh.
Well. Yes. The whole war effort would grind to a halt otherwise." Part 075. One of the potential weaknesses of the arrangement was if the shipment got diverted, or even if Delia or Oliver ate the chocolate bar. Jack and I decided we would tell the Gaffneys an investigation was in progress and that shipments to and from the Americans, either at the camp or hospital, were to be checked carefully by me before anyone else touched them. On Jean's side, Jack was represented as someone whose family were in the food trade, which could cover shipments. That this was true was helpful, of course. Therefore, the messages I was relaying were at several levels. At least we got some interesting bits of food. We were among the first locals to try Spam. At first, not considered a wonderful choice, but later we realized that it did provide meat in a form that was versatile and somewhat indestructible. Part 076. It was early September when things came to a head. I transmitted just one message and received two, but Jack had been around a few times, so we'd managed two weekends together, even though he had on one of them to make a call during which I was left in the car. There were things I did not ask about. What I didn't know, I could not tell. Jack showed up at the farm on a Tuesday night in a car. He wanted me to act as his camouflage again. This time he did tell me in advance what was going on. An American stores officer had arranged to trade a large amount of desirable food items as well as some nylons in exchange for some antique jewelry that had been acquired in robberies or other ways by a London gang of villains. Later in the evening, the jewels would be transferred by swapping two objects that looked alike, such as two similar thermos flasks. This would be done in a local pub. However, Jack wanted to verify for himself the layout of the pub. I would be his camouflage for an early evening drink. Later, two of his detectives would be present to observe the trade, while Jack kept watch outside. Private cars were now scarce, so we parked some distance from the pub and walked a couple of hundred yards. "Tonight I'll try a sherry if they have one," I said. Jack went to the bar to get our drinks, and I went and found a small table with two chairs in a corner. The pub wasn't busy, but there were a couple of older men talking about the Allied invasion of Italy with the landlord, and he didn't seem too anxious to leave the conversation. They were also saying something about Italian POWs doing agricultural work. A pair of American servicemen came in, and one took a chair while the other went to the bar to get drinks. The one who sat had a book. He was close enough that I could see it was an Agatha Christie mystery. I wasn't sure, but it didn't quite seem right. Then I became sure it wasn't right when a couple came in and sat on the other side of the room. She had a book too, and it looked almost identical to the one with the American. Moreover, she didn't fit. Actually wearing stockings. Probably late 30s or early 40s and well-dressed, but hard-looking. Jack came back with our drinks. I'd found a pencil stub in my pocket. Always seemed to need one, so I kept one there if I could. I took the newspaper Jack had been carrying and turned to the crossword puzzle. "Jack, do you think this is right for three across?" Jack momentarily looked puzzled then, seeing I had written books and glancing around the room, said, "I think it works, but it may be that it is too early to put it in." "You mean it might be safer later?" I said. Jack nodded, took the pencil stub, and wrote in "Go LAV and call police," then said, "I think those are right. Don't do too much more. I need to go to the lavatory," I said in a voice that would be loud enough to be audible. I got up and went to the bar and motioned to the landlord to come over. "Pretend I'm asking where the lavatory is, but can you call the police?" The landlord whispered, "Jack needs some help. We don't have a phone, but there's one round the corner. There's a back door by the toilets." I said thank you loud enough that it would be heard if anyone was listening, and disappeared to the back. I went out straight away. There was a car parked there. Since it wasn't there beforehand, it must belong to the couple. They certainly didn't fit the usual clientele here. As I noted, private cars weren't common. Choices. I didn't want the crooks to be able to get away, so I quickly ducked down behind the car and deflated a front tire. If I had the wrong people, we could arrange to get it pumped up again. Then I ran to the telephone. There was someone inside, so I opened the door and said, "I need to call the police. It's urgent. I'll pay you for your call." The woman inside grumbled but let me take over. She hung about outside the door, probably to make sure it wasn't a ruse. 999 had been started in London in 1937. Not quite here yet, and our phones connected via the operator still. "Operator, I need the police. Urgently. Connecting you now, caller. Taunton Police. Hello, this is Mary Morrison. My husband, Detective Inspector Morrison, is at and I named the pub. There is a crime in progress, and he needs support right away." "Oh dear, Mrs. Morrison. It's Sergeant Skinner here. I was at your wedding, and I've only got one special with me. I could send him, but he's on foot. What about the fire brigade? They'd give enough bodies, I think. Good idea. I'll take care of it, Mrs. Morrison. You try to keep out the way in case things go wrong. He hung up. I passed the phone back to the woman, but she said, I'm going to get my husband's cricket bat and see if I can help. Jack Morrison used to be the Bobby round here. Can't let him down now. I walked quickly back to the pub. The car was still there, and the yard was quiet. I noticed the back door of the pub had a latch of the type where you pressed down on a thumb lever to lift the latch bar. And the lever was on top of a half-heart-shaped handle. But this door opened inwards. There was a broom beside the door. I pushed the handle through the loop of the handle and let the head of the broom rest half across the door jamb. The weight of the handle would keep it there, preventing the door from opening. One exit blocked. I walked round to the front door and went in. All was much as before. I hoped nobody noticed I'd gone out one way and in the other, but it seemed people were still all pretending to socialize. The couple had struck up a conversation with the pair of American soldiers on the basis of what a coincidence that we're reading the same book, but soon they'd want to do the swap. Jack looked up questioningly. I sat down and said, any more clues? I think this one should be, and he wrote when. No question mark needed. I said, then this should be, and wrote fire BRGD. Jack said we should think some more before filling in any more clues in case we're premature with those others. We waited a tense few minutes. It was probably only two or three, but felt like hours. And we saw the books being mistakenly picked up, and people starting to say their farewells. A vehicle pulled up and a man in a fire service uniform came in. Heard there might be a need for the fire brigade here, he said. Jack got up and said, everybody stay put. I'm Detective Inspector Morrison and I'm arresting these two American servicemen and this couple on suspicion of various offenses. One of the Americans said, you've no jurisdiction over us. Part of the deal for having the US ever help you out with Hitler. Jack said, you might want to read United States of America, Visiting Forces, Act 1942. UK authorities perform investigations and arrests but hand American service personnel over to courts martial here in Britain for verdict and sentencing, which in some cases is much more severe than the UK permits. I looked, and was glad the Americans weren't carrying guns. However, my relief was short-lived as the woman of the British couple had taken a small automatic pistol from her handbag. I think, Bobby, we'll take our book and leave, and anyone trying to stop us will get a bullet. She grabbed the book she had originally brought and headed for the back with her companion. I'd assumed the man was the boss, but once again was misled. As they headed to the back, I followed, with Jack in quick succession. He whispered, what are you doing? I also whispered, I've barred the back door. If we can shut them between, they won't get away. Meanwhile, the fireman had dived outside. The door to the back unfortunately opened inwards. We pulled it shut, but there was only an ordinary handle. Everyone out the front, Jack yelled, as we heard a muffled blocked from inside and footsteps coming back. Jack and I didn't have time to make it to the door. He pointed to one side of the door, where there was a slight indent for the start of one end of the bar. Jack went the other side, and I noticed he picked up a chair. I realized I'd not taken off my pruning knife, which was in a small sheath on my trouser belt. It wasn't likely to do much against a gun, but it was what I had. I heard the door open, and Bobby came out in a rush. Jack brought the chair down on his head, and he went down at Jack's feet, but the woman was right behind Bobby and I saw the gun being raised towards Jack. I didn't have time to think, but brought my hand with the knife down across her lower wrist as hard as I could. She yelped, and the gun went off as the weight of my blow brought her arm down. Bobby let out a cry and a hole appeared in the back of his thigh. The woman's hand was pouring blood from a deep, long slash. But she was reaching for the gun with her other hand. Jack saw this and punched her in the jaw. He was too close to kick, and Bobby and the broken chair were in his way. Still, the woman was trying to bring her gun to bear, so I grabbed her hair and brought up the knife and yelled, "Drop it or I'll slit your throat, you bitch." At this she did drop it and grabbed her cut hand. Jack quickly picked up the gun and somehow removed the bullets quickly. He yelled, "Can we get some help here?" And a couple of firemen came in along with two men in civilian clothes. Jack said, "Ah. Telford and Hughes. Good. Hughes. Go outside and detain those two American servicemen. Also ask all witnesses to stay until we get their particulars. Telford, get a couple of firemen, and any more help you think you need, and get this pair cleaned up and arrange to transport them to the police station. I'll want both those books as evidence, and we'd better see what's inside." The firemen, their foreman having heard Jack say he was arresting the Americans, had made sure they didn't escape in the confusion. The telephone box lady had also, apparently, heard Jack announce he was making arrests and stood stalwartly in their way with her cricket bat. An hour later, and the names and addresses of all the witnesses had been taken. They'd not left, however, as the event had spawned an unexpected party. The lady from the telephone box was still there, with the cricket bat, as well as the old men who had been at the bar. The landlord was smiling widely. Only the miscreants and Telford and Hughes were missing. Jack had gone with the detained crooks on the fire engine. It was the most convenient vehicle available with four prisoners to transport. A couple of firemen had returned with a tire pump to get the car in the yard mobile, then Jack had come back with one of his detective sergeants, I couldn't remember which one, and the policeman had driven the car away. Jack said, "I'm declaring myself off duty," and ordered another pint. The landlord refused payment, even though Jack said it put him in an awkward position. So the landlord said he'd take it, but then put money in a tankard and said, "Here's a start to contributions for policemen hurt on duty." Well, that could be accepted, and there was probably an official charity to which money could be sent. I had a half of cider. Somehow the sherry and Jack's beer had disappeared. Someone probably drank it. Even in the midst of a police operation. We didn't stay long. Both of us needed to unwind. Jack's police car was now in the yard, so we headed back to the farm, where we had to relate the full story to Mabel and Matilda. Oliver and Delia were fortunately in bed. I was aching to get to bed by the time we were able to excuse ourselves. The bed was narrow, of course, but it felt good to be close. Jack gave me a big kiss. I said that was too much excitement for one night. Yes. Remind me never to get you really angry. I wasn't angry. I saw her, a woman whose name I don't know, trying to kill the man I love. I've known someone who was pushed around and hit, and I'm not going to let someone do that to Mary Morrison. And I can't think of what you could have done better. By the way, barring the door and deflating the tire were quick and sensible thinking. And Skinner said you had suggested the fire brigade, since he didn't have resources to send. So you know, the woman is Betsy Morton, and she runs a quite nasty gang out of Southwark. The book had a lot of antique jewels. We know one piece for certain came from a robbery last year. The Americans are going to be interrogated tomorrow with Jean in attendance. The other book actually had some morphine in it. This was a serious crowd. Does that mean you'll be here another night at least? I asked. Yes. I'm afraid so. Why afraid so? I'm glad. Part 077. Sometime in the afternoon of the next day, I was working in the yard putting some flats and sacks in the byre for tomorrow morning's collection. A woman on a bicycle rode into the yard. Toby barked and bared his teeth but stayed just in front of me. Reggie came bounding too and positioned himself beside me. "Hello. I'm Catherine Scott, a reporter with the Chard and Ilminster News, But we also forward stories to the national press. We heard that someone who lives here was a heroine last night, and we want to publish the story in the next edition. This was something I definitely did not want. I thought of saying I wouldn't tell her anything, but the story could come from others. Could I beg them not to publish? Probably not. Just then Jack arrived in his car. After Jack had been brought up to date, I said who Catherine was, but didn't give Jack's name or position, and had not given mine. Jack said I should inform you that there is an ongoing police investigation related to the events that I believe interest you. Moreover, there are several civilians who performed quite remarkable acts of bravery in support of the police. There are still criminals associated with those we have detained who are capable of hurting those people or their families if they can identify them and locate them. It's possible we will request reporting restrictions, even the possibility a D-notice could be issued. However, we hope that won't be necessary, and we plan to issue a statement tomorrow morning. Catherine said, from what I hear, it's a pretty good story. Jack gave her a big smile and said that I can confirm. I will endeavor to provide as much information as I can in our statement, and I'm sure more will come out as trials of those arrested begin. Catherine asked, "You're not just feeding us a line about civilians being in danger to cover up some police mistake, I hope?" Rather than let Jack answer, I said I can tell you that I was present at the arrest of several people last night at a public house in Taunton, and that there was a serious chance people would have been killed by some of those arrested. I feel certain there are equally dangerous associates of those involved who would not hesitate to hurt people who they felt threatened their interests. Worse, they take resources away from the war effort. Part 078. Somerset Constabulary. Public release of information. On the evening of Tuesday, September 7th, in Taunton, police undertook an operation that resulted in the apprehension of several people and recovery of stolen or illegal trade property. In the course of the arrests, a firearm was produced and discharged. Several members of the public were instrumental, through conspicuous courage, in effecting the arrests, and the constabulary expresses its sincere gratitude for their assistance. Because investigations are ongoing, further details cannot be released at this time. Part 079. The American troops had another bonus in store for Jack, but one he would rather had been omitted. One night soon after the pub incident, the detective chief inspector in Bath was driving back to the police station from an interview with a witness in a separate case when his car was in collision with an American lorry that was, unfortunately, driving on the right-hand side of the road. The chief inspector was badly injured, and lost a leg to amputation. Jack was made the acting chief inspector, then confirmed in the position when it became clear his predecessor would not be returning to regular duties. I went up to Bath the first weekend in December and we took a hotel room for one night to take note of the promotion. I won't say celebrate. We both were excited that Jack had progressed so far already in his career, but we were unhappy that it was at the expense of a colleague, and indeed a colleague that Jack said he respected greatly. I think the constabulary will try to find a role for him to play so he can share his knowledge and intuition, Jack said. We can't really afford to lose his skills, but on one leg it's unlikely he can be operational. It could have been you in that car, I noted. That gives me the chills. There is some discussion of how to approach the Americans. It's not in their interest to have these accidents, but some of the low-level officers are bloody-minded and blame us for driving on what they call the wrong side of the road. I think the senior commanders are aware how important it is that these accidents don't happen.